Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. People get frightened by high blood pressure, which ironically makes it worse. They forget the role that natural changes in their environment, both physical and mental, have on their equilibrium and calm. Blood pressure naturally varies over the course of a day. It goes up in response to emotional and physical stressors, and as we age. Environmental exposures also increase blood pressure. With wireless technologies, ambient levels of radiation have gotten very high. Smart meters installed on homes and businesses, and smartphones, now computers really, never stop searching for a signal so they can download data, exposing the user to constant radiation. With this change, the incidence of hypertension has increased dramatically, along with other distressing heart symptoms like palpitations and arrhythmias. Since hypertension is now promoted as a disease instead of a symptom, doctors are encouraged to push the use of pharmaceuticals to control a level of hypertension that may be transient or even normal or triggered by the overuse of wireless. In fact, maintaining healthy blood pressure is simply caring for your health by building in recovery, nutrient and hormone balance, physical activity, and choosing wired instead of wireless solutions. Today's hour will be devoted to explaining the physical mechanisms involved in blood pressure, in the regulation of blood pressure, including how to treat hypertension without medication. I'm joined by Jeff Fawcett, PhD, an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Welcome to you who are always there in the other chair.
As I am.
As you are always. Where did the idea of turning hypertension into a disease come from? I think this came from the NCCH. Do you want to explain who they are and who they're in bed with?
Well, the NCCH is actually a fairly recent phenomenon. They're a 1990s group that is kind of a collaboration of Novartis, or they're funded by Novartis Pharmaceutical Company, which, not surprisingly, sells a lot of antihypertensive medications. And this group is it's the National Coalition to Control Hypertension. And they're doing a lot of proselytizing of conventional treatments and diagnoses of hypertension. They're really beating the drum. In fact, there was this has gotten so egregious that there's a recent article in the American Journal of Hypertension. You know, these are the true believers, and they were criticizing a study that was just so badly done in promoting treatment of pre-hypertension.
Respiration and
Yes. You have a pulse. You have a pulse, so you have prehypertension. Yeah. Oh my God! There's 70 million people who have prehypertension
because they're alive.
If we can get these drugs into them fast enough, they won't develop hypertension. Yeah. And you know, some of the big guns in this field looked at the study and said, "Oh, good God! You know, this is funded by a pharmaceutical company. They're only testing this one. There's just all these problems. So there's big money in hypertension." But this is a more recent phenomenon that has been building for a while. It's in a way, the official standards started in 1977 with the NIH establishing the standards for hypertension being roughly in the range of what is normal of 120 to 130 over 80 to 85, but it even has a longer pedigree, and this is actually goes. I had forgotten about this until I went back and reviewed an article by Malcolm Kendrick. It has its roots in something that we've talked a lot about on the show, which is risk factor medicine. The general trend in current medical practice of turning symptoms into diseases. And hypertension is kind of a star in this, of a symptom which has been turned into a disease. And it starts with the Framingham study, which began in the 1950s when they started publishing results. And what's really shocking about this is that the Framingham study launched the idea that every increment, every increase in blood pressure increases your risk of death. So that's kind of where the fuel has come for these standards. Oh my God, if you get above normal, you get pre-hypertension, we got to treat it because something bad is going to happen. Well, about 5 years ago, some researchers who published an article in the European Heart Journal went back and looked at the original Framingham study. And what they concluded was, you can't draw that conclusion from the data that they have, a phenomenon that we've also talked a lot about.
Well, yeah, the other problem with this is that people's blood pressure varies enormously throughout the day. So you mentioned that hypertension will vary whether you've just eaten a meal,
yes,
how soon after any kind of exercise, whether you're standing or sitting, or
how
whether
long
your legs
been
are
in
crossed,
that position. Yes.
You know, and then that's to say nothing of just the general kinds of changes that people go through during the day, emotionally or just in terms of hyperarousal. If you're working, if you're just working, sometimes if you took your blood pressure right then, it would be high.
Yes.
So that's presuming that people would be dropping dead all the time, every time.
True enough. Well, to finish the thought here, and this is an important piece of the message here today, is that the Framingham study launched the idea, which has become literally embedded in both conventional and alternative treatments of high blood pressure, that if you have high blood pressure that is above whatever normal is, then you are at increasing risk of dying, of getting a disease or something. And the analogy that Malcolm Kendrick uses in his paper is that the data in the original Framingham study seem to suggest is that there's actually a drop-off point, that through a normal range of blood pressures, there's no ill effect. But after a certain point, there may be ill effects. And he uses the analogy of, if you move to the Himalayas, we're at sea level here, you move to the Himalayas, you're going to be living at 12,000 feet. Well, your system will adapt and you'll do just fine. But if you go another 4,000 feet up to 16,000 feet, your system collapses. So his argument is that what the data, the original Framingham data, show is that there is that drop-off point, that through reasonable ranges of blood pressure, your health is just fine. But it's a symptom of something else. If your blood pressure goes from what it normally is, it's pointing to something else.
You're saying that if you're resting blood pressure, that is, if you're sitting and you're calm and you've been sitting for a few minutes and you take your blood pressure a couple of times, because it'll change, if you take it three times, it'll be different sometimes. If that starts to be consistently getting higher and higher, it either indicates, sometimes if your blood pressure has been, you know, we're talking about normal levels. It used to be, there have been so much history with tinkering with the levels, which are considered normal. For a long time recently, in recent history, it was 120 over 80, and now they've lowered it to 115 over 75, I think, and now they're talking about lowering it.
It's turning everybody into patients.
Well, it's also difficult because if your blood pressure is really low,
yes,
that's
right,
not so good either, you know, because there's a reason for your blood pressure. It's your blood pressure has to do with your blood circulation and stuff. And people, for instance, who are exhausted or sick or have some kind of adrenal drag, you know, where they're in a trough from some kind of illness or effort, they'll have very low blood pressure and they won't feel very well. They're very tired. But the point is that it well, actually, I lost my point. But I think that what I'm trying to say is that there's been this tinkering, and if you see a slight change, the first thing you might think about is whether or not you're fighting a cold or a flu.
Yes.
If you see a shift in either direction where it's suddenly very low or very high compared to what you're used to seeing, incidentally, I do think that it's a good idea for people to just buy, if they can afford it, a moderately priced mm-hmm. blood pressure cuff, because you can use blood pressure as a monitor for all sorts of other issues. Because as you say, blood pressure is your body's voice trying to communicate with
right.
you, and if
yes.
it changes, it's an indicator. So it's a good monitor of either your stress level or your inability to recover, you're possibly fighting a cold, that
yes.
Your thyroid function's off, your adrenal function, et cetera, et cetera. So let's talk for a moment about how blood pressure actually works, what actually is going on, just in case people don't actually grasp what's happening when we're discussing blood pressure. What are we talking about?
Well, let's start with the basics. You have a pump, which is your heart, which draws in blood from two places. It draws in blood from your veins, which is bringing blood back from your body to send to your lungs, and it is drawing in blood from your lungs to distribute oxygenated blood to distribute to your body. The blood pressure from the exertion to do that is the diastolic pressure, which is the lower pressure.
And I always think D for down.
D for down.
Yeah. So the diastolic again is
your heart pulling blood in, and it pulls it in from two places. It pulls in oxygenated blood from the lungs, and then it's pulling in the depleted blood from the body to be then sent back to the lungs to be oxygenated. And the other side of this is the systolic pressure, which is your heart contracting to push blood out into your body, again oxygenated from your lungs, or to push it to deoxygenated blood to your lungs.
Systolic is the higher number.
Systolic is the higher number. And the standard way to measure that is put a cuff on, and they measure it in millimeters of mercury, which is kind of an arbitrary. It's just an arbitrary scale like Fahrenheit or
something. Yeah, it's
something.
An old measurement.
It's an old measurement.
The old equipment.
And so the blood's so you have this pump, and it is exerting pressure, and it's distributing it through blood vessels, arteries. Deliver blood from the lungs or away from the heart, and veins deliver blood from the body to the heart. So veins are toward the heart, arteries away from the heart. Most hypertension effects are arterial because those are the blood vessels where blood is being pushed out. That's where the exertion is. So many of the concerns, although there is a form of blood pressure dysfunction that shows up when the pulling in of blood through the diastolic, what's called diastolic dysfunction, shows up, and that it has a close relationship with heart failure, heart disease properly.
Congestive heart failure.
Now, an important part of the regulation of all of this, of the stiffness of what your heart's doing and how strongly it's pushing and pulling, happens in your kidneys. Your kidneys are one of the chief regulators of your blood pressure. There's a process called the renin-angiotensin system. Angiotensin is a hormone which is a very powerful vasoconstrictor, that is, constricts blood
closes
vessels.
Down, closes down.
Closes them down. Mm-hmm. And angiotensin is the A in ACE inhibitors. Those of you who are either are taking them or are being encouraged to take them. And those ACE inhibitors do is they disrupt the process, the regulatory process that produces that hormone. But on its own, the production of angiotensin in your kidneys regulates sodium potassium balance in your kidneys and water and chlorine balance in your kidneys. And it also stimulates production. And those two things make angiotensin, as I said, is a constrictor of the little blood vessels that run through your kidneys. And that's a vast network of these small arteries that run through your kidneys, because your kidneys is where your blood's filtered. The stiffer those little arteries are, the higher your blood pressure is going to be, because it takes more effort to push push through. And there's a nice feedback mechanism that that angiotensin naturally is produced when your kidneys detect signs of low blood pressure.
Yeah, in other words, you've got a hormone which regulates a pump,
yes,
essentially a cellular pump, which controls this balance between sodium and potassium. So
right.
What this, of course, reminds me of is that people are often told that they have to regulate or reduce or completely eliminate the amount of salt in their diet, and there's some kind of... There's this ignoring that we do have this mineral, potassium, which is a very inexpensive, easy-to-take mineral, which you'd have to really overdose, like in a ridiculous way, to take too much of, that you can add to your diet if you're eating salt, if you eat processed foods, or if you have a sense that you're beginning to have, like your rings are tight, or
yes,
you feel like you're having edema. Yeah. So you take some extra potassium, maybe 99 milligrams a couple times, 2 to 3
yes.
times a day with your with food. But the other thing is that if you don't have sufficient sodium in your diet, people are very different. There's a tendency with conventional medicine in its attempt to care for people in a very easy way, you know, to make it very easy for people to be compliant, to oversimplify individual situations. So some people may be sensitive to sodium. Other people
right.
absolutely have to have sodium because they have a tendency to have these troughs with their adrenal function, so that
right.
their cortisol levels drop down because they're very tired, or maybe it's also probably some genetic predisposition in that direction, but people will have a tendency to either have very high cortisol levels, which is your stress hormone, where it sort of stays too high, and there's a body type for that. It's the apple-shaped body type, weight gain in the tummy, skinny arms and legs. Those people will sometimes have very high cortisol, which will also raise their blood pressure,
mm-hmm.
but very low cortisol happens to people who have a tendency to not recover very well, who get hit with chronic illness or have some other health problem that causes them, or even just they don't have good recovery. That's just part of their mechanism, their mitochondrial function. So they have a tendency to have this low cortisol levels where the blood pressure drops out. And those people actually need sodium. If
yes.
they don't have it, they're in trouble. The adrenals have to have it.
Yeah, it's pretty well known now that I can remember my grandfather back in the 50s had a heart condition, and he was on low sodium diet, and that was just the standard thing that you did. You eliminate salt. But it turns out that they found that some, as you say, some people are sensitive, some people are not, and that depends on individual metabolism, and that's an important thing to pay attention to.
Even if you are really sensitive to it, the truth is that the body needs a certain amount of sodium to function. So this kind of hump?
Well, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. So this kind of yes or no, black and white
yes.
thing is very strange. I mean, the other thing to do is to just ask people to limit the amount of processed foods. You know, a slice of bread has enough sodium for the whole day. So if you're eating unprocessed whole foods that you cook yourself, you can control the amount of sodium and salt that you add to your foods, and you can take some extra potassium, and you can eat potassium-rich vegetables and fruits and things.
As a kind of to pound this nail one last time, when physicians who look at this compare use of refined salt with sea salts, that they don't get the same reactions.
Yes.
If you have just sodium chloride, that produces a very different reaction from Brittany salt or some other salt that has additional minerals in it, which tells you something about that very complex balancing act of different minerals in your system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and increasingly you can get Brittany salt and other sea salts. There's one that comes from the Middle East, I think, as well, from places where it's not restrictively expensive. I mean, you can get it places that make it rather inexpensive, and that is a good way of doing it. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, health educator, and I'm with my co-producer, co-host, and, co-everything in terms of our work here. We're discussing hypertension. We're kind of revisiting the topic since I did shows in the past, but we're sort of going through it again. Let's step back for a moment. We've talked a bit about this intrinsic relationship between the heart, which is a gigantic muscle, and blood pressure. And part of what you've said is that there's an issue in terms of the stiffness of your arteries and your veins. So it has something to do with various situations that can occur that cause stiffening. But the heart and the lungs are very closely linked. Congestive heart failure for people who haven't encountered it in their families for some reason or another is a situation where because the heart is getting weak, the lungs fill with fluid. So the lungs have to work for the heart to work, and the heart has to work for the lungs to work. Why don't you say some more about the relationship between the heart and its function and blood pressure?
The way the heart signaling of the heart happens it kind of in two phases. There's an electrical impulse, and then there's just the mechanical impulse. And the electrical impulse depends on so-called calcium channels opening up. That's how the signal is relayed to the actual muscles. So one of the things that one sees in cases of dysfunction is calcium being deposited in odd places. So it may seem strange, but having good calcium balance, good calcium metabolism, just in terms of making the heart work, is an extremely important thing of getting that electrical signal to work correctly. Because it's the largest consumer of energy per pound of muscle in your body, and it is constantly working, your heart is a big producer or a big user of coenzyme Q10.
And carnitine.
And carnitine. Carnitine, which, surprise, surprise, is rich in meat.
Carnitine, carne, meat in Latin. It's in meat, but you can also purchase capsules that are pharmaceutical grade. If people are vegetarians and they're functioning well as a vegetarian, it behooves them to take carnitine and CoQ10, since it's going to be lower in their diet, along with B12.
Yes. One of the key things in maintaining good blood pressure is maintaining those two systems, that your heart muscle is well nourished, and that you have good calcium balance.
I was going to say that, you know, I already can anticipate what people are going to think when they hear that, is that they're going to start slamming down lots of calcium, which is
right.
What people do. You know, they come to our office, you talk to them, and they're taking yikeso amounts of calcium.
Right.
So, first of all, none of these minerals work in a vacuum. They work in relationship to each other. And the other problem is that if you take more calcium than you need, which would be, certainly I would say, never take more than 1,500 milligrams of calcium, and that includes what you're getting from your food, not just your vitamins. So you have to calculate your food too, which is a difficult thing to do. But if you take more calcium than you need, your body will go, oh my God, there's too much calcium, let's urinate it out right away, get rid of it. So you start spilling, as we say, spilling calcium. The important issue here is not only the balance between calcium and magnesium, and one of the things that we know also is that because calcium is very important for blood pressure, but it also constricts, it's a vasoconstrictor, so it constricts veins and arteries, and magnesium is a natural calcium blocker or antagonist. In other words, they balance each other.
Right.
Magnesium opens the vasio. It vasodilates. So if you have a good balance between the two, your blood pressure should be pretty good, and you need both of them. If you are overdosing on calcium, or if you tend to have low magnesium because of other health problems like thyroid problems or something else, then you may need more magnesium than calcium. People are different. So calcium is not just works by itself. It's not a one-trick pony. And then all your micro minerals, all your other minerals like manganese and boron and all these other ones are very important. And then, of course, your level of vitamin D is essential because most people don't get enough sun on their body. You're not getting 15 minutes during the hot time of the year between 12 and 2. People are avoiding the sun, putting sunscreen on, and not going out at that time. That's your choice. But if you're a light-skinned person, you need at least 15 minutes. Or if you're a dark-skinned person, there's an even bigger problem here. Yes. And we see a lot of African descent people with hypertension because their vitamin D status is so terrible because it takes longer for black skin to form or brown skin to make vitamin D. So they need more like half an hour in the sun. So here, bottom line is you take extra vitamin D, and there's been all this lovely research by Veith and all these other people who have come up behind him who have gone through the literature and shown that natural D3 is not toxic and you can take it. So, you know, we're looking at people taking between 3,000 and 4,000 units a day just to keep a good vitamin D status, unless they're getting a lot of sun. So there's a complicated balance between these nutrients, and most people are not kind of up to the task. But if you don't remember anything else from the show, remember that a good balanced multivitamin, if you don't have any reason why you can't take that at the very least, if you do nothing else for yourself in terms of vitamin, that and vitamin C will help you. But we'll talk more about vitamins after a bit. I'm going off on a toot, sorry. So the heart and the lungs are very important in this situation, and the heart itself being a muscle. Incidentally, the carnitine, what's important to remember about carnitine is that carnitine and CoQ10 affect mitochondrial function in your muscles.
Right.
And the mitochondria are your energy cells. So your heart is your biggest, not your biggest muscle, but it is a muscle that you really hope never stops.
Your heart, one-third of the weight of your heart is mitochondria.
Wow. So you've got these energy cells, they have to be fed, and the carnitine and the CoQ10 are very, very important. And it's important to recognize that particularly, I think the blood thinners and the statin drugs affect your CoQ10.
Oh, well, yes.
Statins are dreadful. For affecting it. In fact, we heard in a conference, at the Orthomolecular Health Conference, that they used to put CoQ10 in statin drugs, and then they stopped for some reason that we'll never understand.
It was Merck. Yet I believe it was Merck who was doing that, and it was too expensive, so they took it out. You know, this is like Henry Ford not putting safety glass in cars because, yeah, it'll save lives, but geez, it'll add a couple of bucks to the price of a car. Sheesh.
So what we've discovered is that, first of all, I guess what we've discovered, to go back and review the principles we've just discussed, one is that hypertension is not a disease, it's a symptom. And in fact, hypertension is there for a reason. It's functioning for a reason. So your body has self-corrective mechanisms, and blood pressure is part of the self-corrective mechanisms. That said, things are happening in the body when blood pressure gets high and stays high, and high is relative to the person. We don't, you know, unless you can actually measure the size of someone's heart and things like that, it's very hard to imagine what their blood pressure and their pulse should be.
I think the way to think about this is that having high blood pressure, it's your body trying to do something. And what is it trying to do? It's trying to get blood to some site.
It's increasing circulation.
Yep.
And there are a variety of reasons why that would happen. Stress, of course, is huge. I'm always surprised at how many people come to one or the other of us to talk about hypertension. And they're willing to do all sorts of things except recover from stress, except for, you know, regulate the amount they're working or whatever, or anyway, build that in. So one principle is that blood pressure is not a disease, it's a symptom, and in fact, it's a normal regulatory system in your body, and that the heart is intrinsic, heart and the lung, health of the heart and the lung, and the kidneys are all actually essential to the functioning of a healthy blood pressure system.
And your adrenals.
Your adrenals as well, and your thyroid. So many of your systems. So again, you've got an alert system in your body. You've got a red light going off telling you that something's going on. And the trick here is not to tape it over so you can't see it, but to come up with some way to understand the mechanisms. So we need to take a brief musical break. I'm Lena Berman. I'm in studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're talking about blood pressure revisited. We're going to take just a brief musical break. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
So worried about what's happening today in the Middle East, you know. And I'm so worried about the baggage retrieval system they've got at Heathrow. I'm so worried about the fashions today. I don't think they're good for your feet. And I'm so worried about the shows on TV that sometimes they want to repeat. I'm so worried about what's happening today, you know. And I'm worried about the baggage retrieval system they've got at Heathrow. I'm so worried about my hair falling out and the state of the world today. And I'm so worried about being so full of doubt about everything anyway. I'm so worried about modern technology. I'm so worried about...
Welcome back. This is your own health and fitness. I'm health educator Lena Berman, and I am in studio with my co-host and co-producer, Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to our over 500 archive shows with our library card feature. Find information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our book is Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. And you can contact us by email at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. We're discussing hypertension, and we've been going through a lot of principles and specifics about what's going on physiologically with hypertension, and stressing the fact that hypertension is not a disease. We are supporting people in exploring this without using hypertensive medications. And the reason is because, as Dr. Fawcett has said so many times, using those sorts of medications are like firemen coming in and removing the smoke when there's a fire and leaving the fire burning. Some specifics about hypertension meds might be in order here. They're, as medications go, they're not the worst. Statin drugs, I would say.
Compared to statins, ACE inhibitors are I don't want to say relatively benign, but
they do their job without doing an enormous amount of damage. But they're still not. You're still losing that sense of what is actually going on in the body.
Well, what it's doing is it's throwing a wrench, literally, in the basic regulatory mechanism for regulating blood pressure. It reduces the one of the pieces here that I didn't describe fully is. Angiotensin not only constricts the blood vessels in the kidneys, it also stimulates the adrenal glands to produce a counterbalancing, a vasodilator called aldosterone.
Wow.
So this mechanism is a nice balanced feedback mechanism that will get hosed up by the various ACE inhibitors. And those are the most commonly used. And then you have calcium channel blockers.
Yeah, that's kind of a no-brainer.
Calcium channel blockers are disrupting not only the electrical signals in your heart or dampening that down, they are affecting other smooth muscles like in your blood vessels. And then there are beta blockers, which affect another process in the electrical signaling in the heart, which are only used in severe cases. But again, it's this disruption of the natural process and not looking at what's underlying. Why is your body saying, I need to get more blood somewhere?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... So some of the things to think about here is, well, obviously the first thing to think about is why this might be happening, why the body is doing this thing if it seems so confusing. I want to go back to something because I know that people listen to the show selectively and they'll call me later and they'll say, I want you to tell me more about the show you did on vitamin D. So I had mentioned that vitamin D regulates calcium deposit. The way it's deposited, making sure that it gets deposited into your bones and prevents you from right. urinating it out and all that. It is synergistic with vitamin K because vitamin K also regulates calcium deposition, but vitamin K is also responsible for maintaining health and integrity in the muscles of the arteries and the vein, or not muscles, but
the smooth muscle.
The smooth, yeah. So it regulates... clotting. It doesn't increase clotting. There is a concern that when people are on a something to reduce clotting, something to thin the blood, that they shouldn't take vitamin K. In fact, I would never recommend taking blood thinner. And we'll talk about. Well, we're not going to do a show about blood thinning, but we're going to talk about blood thinning in the course of this conversation. But if someone is on a blood thinner, they want to take vitamin K, which I would recommend. They just may have to regulate. The amount of blood there. It may change the dose, but it's not. It's very important. And then those drugs also reduce vitamin K. So, so there's lots of different types of hypertension according to the medical profession. There are all these different names. Refractory, you know, which means it doesn't respond to medication, which is true of a lot of blood pressure problems.
The principal one that all of the hoo-ha is about is what's called essential hypertension, which means, you've got high blood pressure and we can't figure out why. There's secondary hypertension, which means that high blood pressure is secondary to some other condition. And typically, if this can be conditions like hypothyroidism or hyperthyroidism that's been diagnosed. Or
hyper or hypo, lower high.
Yeah, lower high. Diabetes, heart disease, all those things can be associated with high blood pressure. So that once you've been diagnosed with one thing, but they'll still throw hypertension drugs at you. Just because that's what they know how to do, as opposed to using that as a way of telling whether the underlying cause is being treated adequately. It's like having a fever. It's like someone's sick. I mean, if the fever breaks, you know that they're getting better. If the fever goes down, and you typically do not treat the fever. Just to get someone, you don't throw someone into a icy bathtub just to get the fever down. You treat the underlying cause.
It's interesting that you used that fever as a metaphor because in fevers there is a point where you don't leave them burning. Obviously, if they get
That's
above
right.
a certain level, yes. then you have to do something. And in the same way, neither of us is suggesting that. If you have really high hypertension, like if you're looking at maybe having a systolic of maybe 180 or 200 or something, and it's over 100 and 110, something like that, for a diastolic, and it goes on for long periods of time, it doesn't sort of drop down and stop. It stays that way persistently. Something well, something should have been happening before that happened, but that is too high. I mean, nobody's blood pressure should stay that high. If it stays that high over a period of many years, it isn't true that if it gets that high and it stays that high for a week, you're going to have a stroke. But if you have really high hypertension that goes on for long periods of time, the kidneys do begin to fail at a certain point. We're talking like 10, 20 years. This is something we see in the African-American community a lot. And in fact, because physicians expect African-Americans to have hypertension, they often just treat them with a diuretic and send them home. I had one client who is a highly educated engineer who was a very large man but was also significantly overweight, and his doctors never said that losing weight might help or that walking might help. So we're not saying you can leave this alone. We're saying look at it as an indication of something and look at the other systems that might be going on. Now, from my perspective, the things to think about when you see, when you're looking at underlying causes, would be homocysteine levels being high. And homocysteine can be checked. Doctors sometimes check homocysteine, but it's very difficult to test homocysteine correctly, and it will sometimes come out in the normal range, and people will still be having transient periods of high homocysteine. This is a malfunction in the metabolism of one of the sulfur-containing amino acids. It is something that's going on while the body is trying to form glutathione, which is your main detoxification chemical in your liver. So it's, again, a process that's trying to do the right thing that gets sort of hosed up. And when people get stuck with high homocysteine, which incidentally you can cause just by eating at one of these restaurants that serves you a pound of meat in a sitting, if you do that. I mean, you know, eating meat from our perspective, for people who can tolerate it, is a good thing. It's nutrient-dense food. It should be organic and ethically raised. But if you eat enormous, you know, upwards of a half a pound and over at a sitting, then you're likely to raise these levels of this metabolite that's on the way to glutathione. So homocysteine is clotty. It is controlled by nutrient density and can be corrected with the correct nutrient program. So it doesn't have to happen, but it is the main clotting factor that we see. So nutrient deficiencies and these DNA variants that predispose you, like homocysteine, but there are other things like MTHFR, which is something that it occurs in people who have trouble methylating, which is a complicated term I'm not going to explain, but I've discussed on the show before, and also someone who misses the reductase or the enzyme for using folic acid, so they need a form of folic acid that's more readily available. It has to be delivered the right way, and it has to be a high enough dose. There are very many other clotting factors. There's lipoprotein A, these ApoE, apoprotein E. There's any number of these things that are
also as just a characteristic of diabetics. Diabetics tend to have red blood cells, which are more stiff. Well, they're actually stiffer than normal. So it's harder. The diameter of a blood cell of a red blood cell is actually bigger than the small capillaries that you have to pass through. So it takes some effort to push those guys through. So the stiffer it is, the harder it is to push it through the capillaries.
Yeah, diabetics also have a tendency to have very, very small particle LDL cholesterol, which is it's hard for the HDL to scrub it out, and it gets left and it forms a clot. So there are these factors that are cardiovascular risks. Now, it's not a good idea to be diabetic for any number of reasons also, and it can be prevented through diet and exercise and nutrients.
I'm here to tell you.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, people who have contacted us who have just been diagnosed with high blood sugars who think they're already diabetic, the good news is that this can be turned around very easily if you are serious about changing your diet and your lifestyle a little bit. People who are chronically ill have an increase in their clotting factors. So your blood gets sticky, and that increases your blood pressure. So chronically ill means any unresolved infection. So we're looking at people with chronic Lyme, people with cephas, people with environmental illness, people who have even maybe herpes to some extent, anything that's a chronic kind of ongoing thing, unresolved dental infections, on and on. You can also look at your family history and get a sense of whether or not you're at risk, although all you have to do is get a blood pressure cuff and see what your risk is. Family history of cardiovascular disease. So you see strokes and heart attacks that happen early, meaning earlier than 50 or in the early 50s before 60. After 60, 65, 70, you may be looking at imprudent lifestyle choices there. Still might be significant if it's all over the family history. Diabetes, obviously. Thyroid disease, very underdiagnosed, just incredible. And depression, because depression is a symptom. And depression is often a symptom of thyroid disease or other hormone imbalances. So there we have it, hormone imbalances. Low testosterone in both sexes, low DHEA in both sexes. Cortisol issues high and low. Cortisol, so your natural stress hormone that tries to activate your energy in your body under stress, if it's chronically high, or it will contest and lower other hormones like testosterone. There's a very close relationship between progesterone in women and hypertension because estrogen is excitatory, and if there's not enough progesterone, which is calming around, then they tend to be in a hyperaroused state. Thyroid, again and again and again, it regulates cortisol. So both progesterone and thyroid regulate cortisol levels. So if someone has chronically high cortisol levels, progesterone will help to give them the mediating effect of the cortisol. If they don't make enough cortisol, progesterone helps to give the body the raw material to make cortisol. You have to have progesterone on board to make it. So it doesn't lower or raise it. It mediates it. And thyroid tends generally to lower cortisol. So people with hypertension often need thyroid. It's one of the, makes me nuts because it's the first thing I think of with hypertension and nobody checks it. Again, if you check thyroid, it isn't enough just to do a TSH or thyroid stimulating hormone because that just is telling you what your brain thinks is going on. You need to do free levels, free, not total, levels of T4 and T3. You need both. You need T3, the active form as well, because that's affected by your hormones. Oxidative stress, gee, how hard is this? Toxins, lead. Lead is big with hypertension. I looked a bunch of studies up. There's some interesting studies about children and secondhand smoke developing pulmonary hypertension later in life. Metal exposures and a lack of sleep. Some of this is what people choose to do. They're very busy. People are very busy. They have things to do. They're important people. They're not sleeping. They think they're proud of it that they're not sleeping. It raises your blood pressure.
And there's increasing research about lack of sleep, lack of rest being implicated in a wide variety of things. Not just hypertension is the least of them.
So sleep is a big deal. So insomnia is a big deal, and insomnia another symptom here, not another thing to give drugs to, but another symptom. Snoring and sleep apnea, big deal with blood pressure. And what we see in the studies, which are really interesting, I just pulled a bunch of studies about sleep apnea. I've got about 5 pages here. All the same things that you look at when you look at problems with hypertension are true with sleep apnea. So before you put a CPAP on your face, you want to check your thyroid levels. You want to make sure that you're not being exposed to a bunch of organic solvents in your work. You want to make sure your homocysteine is under control, that you're not extremely overweight, that your C-reactive protein, a marker for inflammation, is okay. And then allergies, big deal. Allergies, if you eat a food that you're allergic to, 15 minutes, half an hour later, you take your blood pressure, it'll be high.
Mm-hmm.
African descent and vitamin D, we already covered. And then, you know, hey, just getting older and needing more pressure to circulate the blood. I remember that great line from, was it The Sunshine Boys? A movie with Walter Matthau and George Burns, where they're battling and angry at each other. They're very old, and they get together for the first time, and one of them says to the other, "So I understand your blood's not circulating." The other one says, "It's circulating, just not everywhere." So this is your own health and fitness. I'm Lena Berman. We're discussing hypertension. I'm with my co-host and co-producer, Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D.
Could I just interject something here and remind listeners again something we've been saying, and we're going to hammer. I want to hammer on this some, is that the blood pressure that you have, as long as it is not extreme, may be the blood pressure your body needs to get blood around your body.
Yeah, but you can influence that by getting more exercise
yes.
and increasing nutrient
yes.
intensity.
Yes, you can do all those things. But what I'm cautioning people about is, oh my God, I've got hypertension because my blood pressure is 140 over 90. That may not be dangerous, but you have to look at your own situation, what's going on with you.
Well, and I want to say this again because I just can't get over how much this happens and people, how consistently I hear this, but both of us have seen this, that someone will call us to make an appointment to discuss hypertension and they're very frightened. They're out of their minds with fear.
Yes.
And part of it is because the medical profession has done that to them, and part of it is the reason that they have hypertension.
Yes.
Is that they're hyper-aroused for some reason. Sometimes it's an imbalance of hormones. Sometimes it's psychosocial. Sometimes it's stress. I mean, but please do not forget the fact that blood pressure is extremely emotional. If you get a blood pressure cuff, you can do your own biofeedback. You just sit down with your blood pressure cuff. You sit down, you uncross your legs, breathe low in your tummy, and just relax for a minute, and then take your blood pressure. And then if it's 140 over 90, or 145, or 150 over 90, or 100 or something, instead of saying eek, just sit there for a few moments and visualize a place that's like your favorite physical place to be, just your most favorite, most wonderful place, and hear the sounds, and smell the smells, and feel how your body feels there, and remember what it feels like to feel really relaxed and happy. I know one time I did this, I'd been doing sessions with people, and I was very hyper-aroused, and I imagined myself swimming in the Caribbean, and the buoyancy of the water, and the visual light coming through, and the sound in the distance of steel drums, and I took my blood pressure, and it was 115 over 75. It just went from, like, I think it was 145 over 90, and it went to 115 over. So it's very, very important, and you can really do this with yourself. Now, this doesn't always work. It doesn't always work for people, and you still don't want to freak out. So let's talk about what you might do. We've talked about the causes. So, and I've already told you, if you don't do anything else, take a multivitamin. Take a allergy-free. This is if you don't have a thyroid disease, because if you have a thyroid disease, you may have trouble with copper and you may have trouble with iodine. So take a multivitamin, a robust multivitamin with lots of B vitamins. Take vitamin C 3 times a day. Take enough of it so that you don't have gas and loose stools, but, approximating 1,000 milligrams 3 times. People are different sizes, so sometimes it's a little less or a little more. Take some of the obvious antioxidants. We've talked about the CoQ10 and the carnitine is not an antioxidant. The B12, all the B vitamins are protective. All of the B vitamins protect you from homocysteine levels, so the B6 and the B12 and all the other B vitamins. And that's if nothing else. Of course, if you want to get into it, then you have to forget, you know, the role of chronic stress of all kinds and the need for recovery. No, you're not going to eliminate stress. Stress is part of your life. It's part of adaptation and growth. You can't learn without it. But remember that you have to rest and recover, and it doesn't matter whether you actually just sleep or just find a way to relax, take a slow walk, all these various things. You have to reduce sugar in your diet if you want to reduce hypertension. Sugar even more important than too much stimulants. Obviously, if you're constantly stimulating yourself with coffee and green tea and black teas constantly throughout the day and cola drinks, you're going to raise your blood pressure and your blood sugars to a certain extent because it's a stress response. It's a stress response. Test and treat your thyroid and other hormone imbalances. We've talked about the folic acid, we've talked about the B6, the B12, vitamin K, antioxidants like lipoic acid, which reduce inflammation to some extent, CoQ10, carnitine, vitamin E, vitamin C. Omega-3s, very good for thinning the blood, balanced with good amounts of a natural mixed tocopherol vitamin E. If you've got terrible blood clotting problems, it's possible to try some natokinase, which is made from soy, which always makes me nervous, but it's supposed to be very good for reducing clottiness in the blood, but, you know, that's if everything else has failed. Testosterone, thyroid, boosting methylation, if it's needed, not everybody needs to boost their methylation, you will know who you are, because if you take some T, like Tom, M like Mary, G-like George, TMG, trimethylglycine or betaine, and you feel better consistently with it, and you don't take too much, take an amount that makes you feel good without feeling overstimulated, excuse me, you might need that. But you can overmethylate somebody, and not everybody needs it. I don't need it, for instance. Jeffrey does well on TMG, but can take too much of it. I don't need it. I can't take it. It makes me feel lousy. So if it doesn't make you feel good, obviously you don't take it. You need also, for protecting your blood pressure health, to increase nitric oxide. This is not laughing gas. This is nitric oxide, which is made in your body. And natural ways of increasing that are to use arginine and ornithine. Use arginine and ornithine together. It's the arginine that does the job. The ornithine potentiates arginine. Ashwagandha, the herb ashwagandha, an adaptogen, seems to work well for people who take it without stomach distress or who feel good on it, will increase nitric oxide. This is a DNA variant that you can test for. If you don't want to test, you can try some of these things. Reduce inflammation, resolve infections. Curcumin, turmeric, is good for inflammation. Reduce your toxic load. There are chelators, natural chelators for lead and other. There are tons of chelators that are natural. There's saunas. There's all kinds of ways to chelate. And don't forget about vitamin C. It's a main chelator. Exercise and breathing. Breathing! What a thought, breathing. Now, another thing is I found a wonderful study which reminded me of this protein-to-carb ratio. People with hypertension, especially pulmonary hypertension, have a problem with this ratio. The more carbs they eat, the more oxygen they need to burn and the more problems they have with breathing. So people with hypertension respond very well to a protein-rich, low-carbohydrate, you know, where carbohydrates come from vegetables instead of from starches, diet works very well. I see it all the time. Treating and eliminating allergens, food allergens and other allergens using homeopathics and food adjustments in food will lower blood pressure and pulse. Sleep and recovery. Remember that alcohol late for some people with food will wake them up in the middle of the night. Sugar, stress, hormone imbalances, so they can't. Hormones huge. Thyroid, estrogen, testosterone interferes with sleep if it's too low. Sleep apnea studies, all of the same problems as everything I just said. All sleep apnea studies go back to toxins, allergies, weight, hypothyroidism. And then there's, you know, various rescue remedy is a wonderful remedy for calming, and there's herbs and homeopathics, and way too much stuff for us to go into in the context of this show. And of course, remember that what I mentioned at the top of the program about wireless technologies, they all increase hyperarousal and fight or flight. So they raise blood pressure, increase heart symptoms like palpitations and arrhythmias, and make sleep really difficult. So unplug everything wireless at bedtime. If you use a smartphone, keep it away from your bedroom and experiment with unplugging completely to see if that lowers your blood pressure. Whenever possible, it's healthier to choose a wired internet, phone, and computer, including your mouse and your keyboard. Opt out of the smart meter program. Turn off your computer's Bluetooth and airport card. And if you buy a new car, avoid the wireless options. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, Your Own Health and Fitness, for easier, extended access to our over 500 archive shows with our library card feature. Find information about our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. Email us if you need to reach us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.